This is a CBC podcast. Make your own profile at the CBC Member Center, and you can post comments, photos, and videos at cbc.ca. You can also sign up for our news, sports, entertainment, radio, and podcasting newsletters. Just head to cbc.ca to sign up for the CBC Online Member Center.
From the Rebecca Cohn Auditorium in Halifax, Nova Scotia, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
How nice to be back in Halifax. And how especially nice to be back here among the ivy-covered walls of Dalhousie University, home of King's College and its fascinating Foundation Year program, and of the Dalhousie Gazette, which published its first edition in 1868, the year after Confederation, making it the oldest student newspaper in Canada and one of the oldest in North America. Read on the net this morning that only Harvard, Yale, Princeton, McGill, and the University of Toronto have produced more Rhodes Scholars than Dalhousie. So it is more than nice to be here. It's a privilege and an honor. If you listen to this show regularly, you'll know that one of the things we try to do is to shine the light on young Canadian musicians, on people we think deserve a bit of attention, people who might not otherwise have the light shone upon them. I saw our first musician for the first time a couple of years ago at a benefit concert for Phoenix Youth Programs, an organization that does wonderful work for homeless and at-risk teenagers right here in Halifax. Since I saw him, he has performed across Canada and North America and much of the world. He flew in from London, England to join us on this tour. The recent winner of 2 East Coast Music Awards, one for Blues Recording of the Year and the other for Male Solo Recording of the Year. Ladies and gentlemen, from Perth Andover, New Brunswick, Matt Anderson.
Sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. There ain't no sunshine when she's gone. She's always gone so anytime she goes away. I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. There ain't no sunshine when she's gone. This house just ain't a home. Anytime she goes away. And I know. Hey, you oughta leave young thing alone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. There ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Only dark is every day. There ain't no sunshine when she's gone. my house, just ain't home when my girl goes away.
Say about that. I guess I should tell the folks at home that everyone was standing here in the theater, and that Matt will be back later in the show, and once he warms up, maybe he'll put a little bit more of himself into his performance. It's now my delight to introduce our next musical guest. She was born and raised in London, Ontario, but she came to her senses about a decade ago and moved here to the East Coast, here to Halifax. She has sung with Sarah McLachlan at Massey Hall. She's toured with Ron Sacksmith, and after this tour, she'll be opening for K.D. Lang for a month and a month-long tour across America. And if that isn't enough, she just signed a 5-record deal with Warner Records, which is unheard of these days for a young Canadian singer. Let me tell you why you're here today. You thought you were coming here to see me. Real reason you're here today is so that you can say, I saw her before she became a star. Ladies and gentlemen, Megan Smith.
Sing you a little song that I wrote for somebody very special to me. I wrote this next song for my grandfather. I'm pretty sure he loves me. He doesn't ever say it, but that's okay. Because I know. It's in our hello, in the way your smile glows. And it's in our goodbye, the tear in your eye. And all in between, when you're looking at me, I know, I know, I know what you don't say. Shimmers through the things that you do, like when you write me a note and you send it by post, and what you might not sign on that bottom line, I know, I know, I know what you. What goes unsaid? Well, you'll leave me with this, a hug and a kiss. Oh yes, and that little phrase, those three words you can't say. Hey, but please don't be blue, 'cause I always knew, and I know, I know, I know, and I love you too.
That was Megan Smith. As I know, and that's from Megan Smith's EP called Crickets Quartet. It's time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short stories, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. And after that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we promise we'll read some of our favorites on the radio. Today's story comes to us from Michael Calderwood, who lives in Brighton, Ontario. Dear Stuart, writes Michael, my first parish as an Anglican minister was in Newfoundland and Labrador in the small outport called Trinity East on the north shore of Trinity Bay. It was the 1990s. The fishing business was in trouble. My wife Karen and I had just moved from Toronto, and I soon realized that we could fit all the residents of Trinity East into one Toronto subway car. I knew in order to do this job well, I had to learn about the fishery. And what better way to do that than to get out on the ocean and see it for myself? It was cold the dawn I stepped into the boat and waited for the third cup of coffee to take effect. My parishioner, Ray, who was taking me squidding, started his mercury outboard and off we went. We drove for about an hour, Ray watching the seagulls, who he said always knew where the squid would be. And then we stopped, and Ray pointed at the gulls circling overhead. Put down the jigs, he said. There were four large spools on the gunwales, rolled with hundreds of meters of heavy fishing line. Every 30 centimeters or so, there was a small hook, a jig, which would grab onto the squid's body. It was crude, but it was effective. I let down the line until I was told to stop. My captain told me to rock the spools back and forth, back and forth. Keep going until I felt the weight of the squid on the end of the line. "Haul her up!" Ray shouted. I could not have been prepared for what I was about to see or hear. Squid, all about the size of my hand, came flying off the jigs into the bottom of the boat, their gills gasping for water. There were more squid than I'd ever seen in my life in that boat, and I could tell by the look on Ray's face that this was a good catch. He looked happy, and I was proud and honored to be part of the day. "Now what?" I asked. "Well, my son," he said, "you've got to separate the males from the females." "How do we do that?" I asked. "Well," he told me, "if you pick them up and look closely through their tentacles, just below their eyes, you can see the difference." Now, that sounded reasonable to me. I'd taken enough marine biology as an undergrad to know that it was possible to tell the difference between a male and a female squid. And as a minister, I knew God had created them so. What I had forgotten, however, was that over millions of years of evolution, squid had developed sophisticated defense mechanisms. Sophisticated, though not very precise. But when you are a squid swimming through the cold waters of Trinity Bay, when you are a squid trapped in the bottom of a dory gasping for air, when you are a squid being picked up by an Anglican minister who until very recently lived in downtown Toronto, you do not have to be very precise. I picked up a squid and tried to determine its gender. "You might have to hold that a little closer," Ray said. And that was the last thing I remember hearing. The ejection, if not precise, was certainly thorough. The fact that it got into my ears surprised me. It was thick, it was cold, and it was too salty to describe. It splashed over my face, covered my eyes, went further up my nose than I care to remember. It tasted like nothing I had ever tasted before. With my ears clogged, I could hear only one sound rising above the squishing of the squid on the bottom of the boat. It was my captain, my very much amused captain, laughing harder than he had laughed for a long time. My initiation into the community had begun. The story came to us from Michael Calderwood of Brighton, Ontario. This is Megan Smith.
Here I go again, smiling too sweet. Can't seem to hold it in. Every time that we meet, I get this rosy glow and weak in the knees. I hope you don't know how fast you make my heart beat. I'm my heart. seems that my heart has finally gone and told on me.
That was Megan Smith. That was A Little Love, and that's from Megan Smith's EP called The Crickets Quartet. We're going to get Matt Anderson up here again. Matt's going to do one of his own tunes now.
Smile, babe. Would you wish you never asked for my name? When you pour all your heart on that last fallen star, will that be the wish that you make? Do you ever think about, babe, how right it felt when it was good? How I'd shoot out the moon, babe, just to hold you in the dark if I could. How we'd stay up all night just to feel the sunrise. Well, do you ever think about it, babe? 'Cause it's been so long now since I talking, babe, talking to myself about you. Trying to figure out all of those things I wouldn't do for you. How I didn't even try when we said I've been talking to me, babe, 'cause it's been so long now since I let you down, and I don't know how. So gone now. out on the road, babe, with nothing to do but pass the time. I'll pull away from the towns, babe, just like I did to you, and I'll leave them behind. When I see just as your friend, oh, you know I'm sorry, but that's just how it's gonna be now, baby. 'Cause it's been so long now since I left. And I don't know how. You are so gone now. Yes, it's been so long now since I let you down. So gone now.
Thank you very much.
That was Matt Anderson, and that was So Gone Now, and that is off Matt's album, Something in Between. So to get to his record store, get to the vinyl cafe, Dave has to walk by his friend Dorothy's bookstore every day. Or every day he walks to work, which is pretty much every day. It's Dave's habit to drop in on Dorothy most days. Sometimes he takes her a coffee from his pal Kenny Wong's place. Wong's Scottish meat pies. But mostly he comes empty-handed, and mostly he doesn't stay more than a few minutes. But you can build a deep relationship on little moments when those moments add up over the years. So he's in there one morning, and he and Dorothy were having one of those conversations that good friends have, talking about nothing they hadn't talked about before, singing the old familiar song of friendship. When Dave abruptly changed the subject, said, "How long's that been there?" He was pointing over Dorothy's shoulder at a shelf behind the cash register. Dorothy didn't turn to look. She didn't have to. Dorothy knew what he was talking about. He was talking about the Jonathan Cape edition of the Ian Fleming novel Goldfinger, number 7 in the James Bond series. Dorothy said, "I didn't know you were a fan of Mr. Bond." Dave said, "We go way back." Dave first met James Bond in the town of Big Narrows, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Town where he was born and raised. Didn't meet Bond in a bookstore or a movie theater, for that matter, where most people made his acquaintance. There was neither a bookstore nor a movie theater in the Narrows when Dave grew up. He met him at the most splendid building in town, the town library. Library was built and paid for by the coal magnate John A. Tress, who built it in memory of his sister. The Mary Tress Library is, to this day, the only brick building in the Narrows, sitting as leisurely as a bank near the end of Main Street. It's only a single room, but it is a splendid one. Inside, it has a vaulted ceiling and a balcony with a wrought iron railing running all around it. Outside, it has wooden columns and a stone stairway leading up from the sidewalk all the way to the front door. It is way out of scale with anything else in the Narrows, and it is the town's pride and joy. The librarian was an earnest bibliophile from Edinburgh, Scotland, a fussy and strict man who believed in doing things by the book. Mr. Russell Montgomery ran the Big Narrows Library for 54 years with the intensity that J. Edgar Hoover brought to the FBI. He was a different sort, no doubt about it. Narrows had never seen the likes of him before, a square peg in a town of round holes. He wore argyle socks and ox blood brogues and carried little tins of fruit drops that he had shipped over from home. He could have been a disaster, but he was loved by all for his love of literature and his deep commitment to share his literary passion. The town used to orbit the library in those days, and he was the sun king shining from his throne of books. There are things that still happen in Big Narrows today that Mr. Montgomery began, things like Story Circle, for example. This is where the kindergarten kids assemble at the library on Monday mornings to hear stories. They did that when Dave was a boy, and they do it still today. Still at Christmas, Mr. Montgomery, who is retired and well into his 80s, comes and reads Clement Clark Moore's A Visit from St. Nicholas to everyone, and at Easter, Beatrix Potter's Peter Rabbit. And most famously of all, every Halloween, his Pièce de Résistance, the fearsome saga of the Black Beast of Margerie. It's a legend of the mythical dog-like creature that haunts the hills around the Narrows. According to Mr. Montgomery, the beast was first spotted by an early settler who lost all his livestock in one horrible summer, all of them from violent throat injuries. The story of the Black Beast isn't written down. Mr. Montgomery heard it himself from the great-grandson of the original farmer. He tells it extemporaneously, his body swaying back and forth in the telling. Every kindergarten kid listening, swaying back and forth in time like frightened little metronomes. Under Mr. Montgomery's guidance, Dave whiled away hours exploring the treasures of John Tress's library. Mr. Montgomery was his guide, his compass, and his map. Ernest Thompson Seton or Ernest Miller Hemingway, Dr. Livingston or Dr. Seuss, they were all the same to Mr. Montgomery. Wise in the ways of children, Mr. Montgomery would as happily bend Fenton as Thomas Hardy to his literary purpose. And his purpose was to arm children with books, any books. The summer Dave was 13, Mr. Montgomery gave him Herman Wouk's The Caine Mutiny. Dave read most of it in a little park beside the library under a stand of sweet-smelling balsam trees. When he finished, he returned it to the library and said, "I want another one, like that one." Now, Mr. Montgomery came from a family of trout fishermen. He had spent time on the banks of Scottish rivers. He knew what he had here. He had a boy on the line. What he had to do now was set the hook. And that is when he handed Dave Casino Royale, the first in the James Bond series. He'd been saving the book at his desk for just such a moment. It was the coup de grace. Dave galloped through that one and the other three bonds in the library collection, and then he handed himself over to Mr. Montgomery. He read anything Mr. Montgomery told him to read, Dickens and Richler, Twain and Le Carré. Now, this was back in the days before television came to the Narrows, and back in those days there was no movie theater in Big Narrows either. If you wanted to go to the movies, you had to drive all the way to the Savoy Theater in faraway Glace Bay. Something so improbable, so unlikely, that Dave never considered going to the movies a possibility until the summer of 1964, the summer Goldfinger was released, starring Sean Connery. There was a province-wide contest promoting that movie. You might remember it. There were five simple skill-testing questions. The winner in Cape Breton would receive a pair of tickets to the Savoy Theater for the Saturday matinee of the week-long run. Every kid in the Narrows wanted to win those tickets. None of them could figure out the answers to the questions. Dave knew he could find them in the book, so he went to Mr. Montgomery. He begged him to get Goldfinger into the library. It was while they were waiting for it to arrive from the book room in Halifax that disaster struck. Dave returned Huckleberry Finn to Mr. Montgomery in grievous condition. That was Mr. Montgomery's description, grievous condition. "It's just honey," said Dave. The book was lying on the library desk. Mr. Montgomery had his hands uncomfortably over it, snapping his sticky fingers open and closed in distress. Mr. Montgomery wrinkled his nose. "I'm putting you on warning. Be careful." Dave was desperate. "If you set it outside for an afternoon, the ants will clean it." Mr. Montgomery pulled out his stamp pad and stamped Dave's library card with a black rat. Three rats and your card was suspended. Dave got his second rat a week later. He dropped To Kill a Mockingbird into the bathtub. When he returned it, it looked more like an accordion than a book. Mr. Montgomery just shook his head sadly and reached for his stamp pad. It was the very next afternoon that Billy Mitchell found The Swallow. He found it in the lane back of the laundromat beside the Maple Leaf Cafe. It had stunned itself flying into Art Gillespie's office window. Billy carried the bird around in a shoebox for a couple of hours, showing it to everyone. And then, egged on by Warren Sarhour, he took it to the library with a devious plan to set it loose from the upper balcony. Unfortunately, Dave was up there when they arrived, poring over a well-thumbed copy of the National Geographic, the famous issue dedicated to the women of Africa. Billy handed Dave the shoebox. "Check this out," he said. When Dave opened the box, the swallow flapped out with a squawk. It flew around and around the domed ceiling like a magic trick, banging up against the glass roof, feathers flying. When Mr. Montgomery looked up, Dave was standing beside the railing holding the box. Billy Mitchell and Warren Sarhour had vanished. Dave said, "It wasn't my idea." Mr. Montgomery suspended his card for a month. His card was still under suspension when Goldfinger arrived. Dave didn't have to go to the library to know the book was there. Mr. Montgomery put the book jacket in the display case by the front door, right where Dave would be sure to see it on his way to school. It looked amazing. There was a picture of a skull in a pine box with coins in its empty eye sockets and a rose between its teeth. It was the same jacket that Dorothy had on her shelf behind the cash register in her bookstore. Dave went to the library right after school. Mr. Montgomery was sitting under an umbrella. The swallow had built a nest at the top of the domed roof. Dave ducked under the umbrella. He asked Mr. Montgomery to make an exception, just that book, just this once. Mr. Montgomery told him he couldn't sign it out until his suspension was over. Dave begged, "Can I sit in the library? Can I read it in the library?" Mr. Montgomery shrugged, "But how would you get in the library? You have no library privileges." Getting in was easy. He got in the next night through the coal chute. Saturday night, 8:30, everything shut up tight, down the alley, behind the library, in, out, 5 minutes. His plan was simple. He would plow through the book over the weekend and return it first thing Monday morning. Monday, of course, was reading circle. The kindergarten kids would be there. He would take his dog Scout with him and use Scout as a distraction. Scout loved kids. Kids loved Scout. Whenever Scout saw kids, he would bound towards them with his tongue out, ready to lick. Getting a dog down a coal chute is harder than you'd think. On Monday at recess, Dave was in the alley behind the library, hoisting Scout up, trying to shove his bottom through the chute door. Scout was hunching and scrabbling and doing his best not to go. "Scout," said Dave, and he leaned into him, and off they went. A tumble of dog and boy that landed with a thud on the coal room floor. Dust everywhere, the two of them peering at each other in the gloom of the basement. If dogs could grin, surely that's what Scout did then. He grinned and he barked and he began bounding around the coal room with his tail wagging, a picture of doggish joy and excitement disappearing in and out of the clouds of black coal dust. "Scout," said Dave, trying to calm him down, but there was no calming Scout. He was barking with abandon. His tail was wagging, and then he saw the stairs, and he headed right for them. Upstairs, the children in reading circle were, one by one, beginning to hear the commotion, beginning to turn toward the basement door. Not all of them, but at least half. And that's when the door burst open and Scout exploded into the library, howling and barking, a black cloud, a howling, dust-choked energy. And in the midst of the whirlwind, two blazing green eyes, a set of long white teeth, and it was Colin McGregor who recognized who it was. It was Colin who stood up and pointed and screamed, "It's the Black Beast of Marguerite!" "He's going to rip our throats open." Colin flung himself at the nearest shelf of books and started scrambling up. Others followed, kicking books off the shelves as they climbed. But only Colin made it to the very top. As soon as Colin got there, the shelf began to rock slowly back and forth. And Colin stood there at the top, like the soldier on the top of the war memorial, and wrote it all the way down. Mr. Montgomery and his umbrella were buried by the avalanche of flying books. When he finally surfaced, there was a moment of complete and utter silence. And then, to add to the indignation, the swallow spotted Mr. Montgomery's bare forehead and sensed its chance. In the commotion, no one spotted Dave standing at the top of the stairs. When he saw the shelf coming down, Dave turned and ran. Down the stairs and through the coal room door, he hurled himself at the chute. He was still clutching Goldfinger. He dropped it halfway up the chute and watched it tumble into the coal bin. He wasn't going back for it, that's for sure. Not for the book and not for Scout. Scout was on his own. Of course, he never entered the contest. Having read the book, he knew all the answers, but he couldn't let on. If he entered the contest, he would have won it, and Mr. Montgomery would have figured out that was him in the library that morning. Billy Mitchell won the trip to Glace Bay. Billy, who found the swallow. Where's the justice in that? "And that's about all of it," said Dave. "A good story," said Dorothy. "A long time ago," said Dave. He was sitting on the stool that Dorothy has by her cash register. He opened the copy of Goldfinger that she had handed him. He began flipping through it. "I always loved the part where Oddjob was sucked out the plane window." And then he smiled and he threw the book in the air and caught it. 13 novels, he said. And Fleming only lived long enough to see 2 of the films. He looked at his watch. He said, "I have to go." The letter came a month later, a white form letter in a white envelope, postmarked Big Narrows, Cape Breton. "Thank you for your kind donation of Goldfinger by Ian Fleming. The book is being cataloged and added to our stacks. It's now in circulation and available for members to borrow. It is through donations such as yours that our library remains a vital part of the community." There was a P.S. at the bottom written with a fountain pen in a spidery hand. "David," it began. "To answer your question, the library is open Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoons. There's no longer a permanent librarian. It's run by a committee and staffed by volunteers. Aside from the hours, nothing much has changed since you were a boy. We haven't bought any new books for well over a decade, though people do donate books from time to time. Your check is most appreciated and will be added to a fund to make some general repairs, most critically to the roof. I checked, and we do have all 13 books in the Bond series, plus the short stories. Our copy of Goldfinger, however, is damaged. It looks as though it has been set afire." "Although you already knew that, didn't you?" "We'll replace our copy with the one you sent. We'll sell the damaged one in our autumn sale, and I would be delighted to buy it for you as you requested. I'll keep it at the house for when you are next in town. I saw your mother and told her about your kind donation. She said you always liked the library, and you spoke fondly of me. Thank you for that." It was signed, Russell Montgomery. Dave read the letter twice, and then he folded it carefully and put it back in the envelope, and he put the envelope in the drawer below the cash register in his store. That night on his way home, he stopped at the video store and rented a movie. "Have you seen it?" he asked Morley when he got home. "James Bond," she said. "An early one," said Dave. "Goldfinger, one of the ones with Sean Connery." "I thought you'd seen them all," she said. "Not this one," said Dave. Thank you. Unfortunately, we've come to that part of the show where we have to say goodbye. I'd like to take a moment to thank everyone who shared the stage with me today. Dennis Pendrith on the bass. John Sheard on the piano. Jason Mingo on guitar. Megan Smith and Matt Anderson. Thanks this week to Pat Martin, Rod Snedden, Stuart Young, Brad Scrutton, and Bill Herault for the technical assistance. David Amer is the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. And Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean in Halifax, and we're going to get Matt Anderson to sing us home now. So long for now!
Come by morning, come by noon, come by evening, stay till dawn. Well, I'll make all right what has been wrong. Come by walking, come by plane, come by sail, baby, come by train, come by run. Fine, you wait and see. Come.
rest your head, yeah. Where you'll find sweet dreams here in my bed. Come by good times, come by pain, come by the sunshine, come by rain, come by always. Don't you worry about the time. My open arms is all you're gonna find. Go ahead, Johnny.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.